Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is TWiG, This Week in Google, episode 25 for January 17th, 2010. The People's Republic of Google. This Week in Google is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Do more and travel less with GoToMeeting. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/TWiG. It's time for TWiG, This Week in Google, and we've got a big, really big show for you with the regulars, of course, starting with Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com. It's good to see you, Jeff.
My Android ready with questions.
Oh, good. Yeah, this is going to be the Android Nexus One tip show, I think, because Gina Trapani and I are big fans. There's Gina Trapani.
There's mine with
SmarterWord.org. Am I supposed to hold mine up too now? Since we're all in the family, and of course joining us. Let's see if Siva's going to be joining. Yes, he.
It's an iPhone.
Yeah, it's an iPhone. Siva Vaidyanathan, who is the author of the Googleization of everything.
It's so 2007.
Even Steve Wozniak gave up the iPhone.
You are a classicist, Siva.
Siva is a professor at University of Virginia.
That's correct. Yes,
UVA, yes. Thomas Jefferson's alma mater.
Yep.
And here, because I think you have quite a bit to say about the big blockbuster story of the week, the late night shenanigans with Conan O'Brien and Jay Leno. I think it's going to be the whole show. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that Google got so pissed off at the world's largest nation, the world's biggest group of internet users, that they're ready to pull out. You wrote a great blog post, I thought, Jeff, applauding Google, saying, yay, this is how, if you're gonna do no evil, this is how you do it. Why don't you give us the rundown of what happened, then we'll get a dissenting opinion.
Well, it is a chicken-egg question as to what actually caused this. There were cyber attacks on Google, and I think the number is now more than 30 other companies. And Google said they were going after the email accounts of people fighting for human rights and other things, including, I think, Google Code as well, and that of other companies. Not ever said directly that this was the Chinese government. No smoking hacker to show that it was the Chinese government, but the assumption is that it is.
Well, in fact, I think Secretary of State Clinton thinks it is, because I think she said, the State Department said, we want some splaining to do, China. Right. You got to say what happened. So,
and at the same time, it came along that they said that they were going to sometime in the near future stop censoring Google.cn results at the behest of the Chinese government. And we're going to open discussions with the Chinese government about whether they could stay there, which is to say that they're threatening to pull out. Is that a fair summary?
Seems so. Siva, well, and I should say that, Jeff, you applauded it, as I did.
Yes.
When I heard about
it. Being the official Google fanboy, having written the book on being a Google fanboy, I was looking for a copy, but the one thing that people always throw at me and that I throw at Google is Google's China policy. And as far as I'm concerned, that Google stands to benefit from free speech more than any other company ever, even more than publishers. It enables free speech, and I thought that Google should stand up for free speech as a result. And Google, its old policy was that a hampered Google was better for the Chinese people than no Google at all. But I argued in the book, and since, that Google has more power here than even it knows, and that the problem I see with China is that because the market is so large and our lust for its revenue and the fact that it holds us by the short hairs in debt has made everyone chicken to go after China and demand something better. You have companies like Yahoo that have handed over email addresses for dissidents. Cisco, Nokia, Siemens are helping China in their censorship. Steve Ballmer this week threw Google under the bus and said, I don't know what's the problem. He was kind of like the Jay Leno of technology. I think it's important to stand up. Siva, in his very good post, and he and I, as we always do, civilly disagree on some of the points and not all, does make the analogy that I make as well to apartheid. And at some point, you stand up for standards, for principles. And the interesting thing, I think, too, about Google here is that Die Zeit in Germany called Google a quasi-state under the headline, I think it was the Google Reich. Jim Fallows from Atlantic Magazine, who knows China well, the way he phrased it was that Google had cut off diplomatic relations with China. And the interesting thing to me is what we're seeing here rise is the rise of what I call interest states, that Google is really acting a bit like a country. And it has the economy itself that's the size of, I think, the 29th largest country in the world. And so we're starting to see these cross-border influences. And so the fact that Google is going up against China rather than the U.S. or the EU or European countries tells a lot.
Before we get to Siva, Gina, you concur?
I do. I mean, it was a gutsy move. It was one that I also applauded and celebrated. I found it very interesting that the cause, you know, the events that led up to it, right? The hacking, the surveillance, and then the making that decision. I pretty much concur with Jeff. I don't know. I feel like maybe Google being, you know, another kind of state feels like a little bit of a stretch for me, but, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I can tell you how to use Android, but I'm not the one you want commenting on politics or business. So I'll go with Jeff on that one.
Yeah. I mean, look, Google's just a big company. If Ford decided not to make cars in China, there's economic clout that a big company has. Well, Google's only 31% though of the search engine business in China. Baidu is much bigger.
Sorry to put it this way, but Google is the new Coke. In that sense, the Coke was the symbol of America and the symbol of capitalism,
right?
And Google is that now,
right? Well, certainly it's gotta have some impact. Now, Siva.
Yeah.
What's your thought?
The only major statement of Jeff's that I want to take issue with is that Google is the new Coke, because Coke is still Coke. Coke is still a dominant brand and in many ways the world's favorite corn syrup flavored beverage. So that's not changed. No, but I actually am a bigger fan of this move than I think Jeff is. And I'm a bigger fan of Google's policy in China over the last 5 years than Jeff is, or just about anybody, actually. And I'll explain why. So first, let me say, I don't believe in corporate responsibility. I actually don't think it's Google's business to be in the business of liberating anybody or enhancing anybody in particular's political agenda. But that's a nice byproduct of this, okay? Within limitations, because I actually don't think Google has that much influence. Now, Google may be 31% of the current Chinese internet market, but we are talking about 100 million users, because just over 300 million people in China use the internet every day. But we also have to remember that the vast majority of people in China are basically subsistence farmers. So the government of China has far bigger problems, challenges, issues, and thorns in their side than Google could ever present. So that, with that context. But let me explain, first of all, why I think that for the past 5 years, Google's been doing the right thing in China. First of all, Google has never had the power to empower anybody. The people in China who are fighting for their rights to speak, their rights to practice their religion freely, their rights to raise little girls on equal terms, right? All of those important human rights, flesh and bone issues are so much deeper, broader, and more grave than search results could ever affect. Having people in China be able to Google Falun Gong or find pictures of the tank man from the Tiananmen Square incidents in 1989 is not going to improve anyone's life significantly. Now, those are all sort of side issues just to sort of play. I think this particular move is important.
Oh, Siva, we're getting some hesitation on your Skype.
It's icing on the cake. It's nice that they get to feel good and make us feel good, and get, you know, human rights organizations to applaud them finally. But basically, for the past 5 years, they have not been a human rights problem in China. While Cisco is, while Yahoo has been, Google was very deft and careful about how it did business in China.
Cisco, it turned over information about dissidents.
Well, not just that.
Cisco, I think, sells technology there, right?
That's the problem. Yahoo did turn over information about dissidents. Now, you have to do that if you have that information within the People's Republic of China, right?
By law.
So in a lot of ways, Yahoo made the mistake of actually being there with sensitive information. That was a dumb move from the beginning. Once you're there, you kind of have to obey the law, right? So, but Cisco is far worse, largely because Cisco is actively selling the sorts of technologies that China uses.
The filters, yeah.
To do, well, it's not just the filters are a big part, but they're China's major tool for limiting the distribution of unsavory material is the surprise reset of your connection, right? So they have these like ways of just blipping out people's connections if they end up going to bad places or places the Chinese government doesn't like. In general, also, the Chinese government makes sure that there are really, I think, only two major channels into the People's Republic, and it's very easy for them to block YouTube and block Blogger and block any service that they consider, Facebook, which they often do, which they consider potentially troublesome. So that's how China does its thing. But Google 5 years ago decided to do the following. Google.cn would be hosted in China because you need to do that to get it to run at a decent speed and to be able to work on the linguistic challenges that are so important in search. You really need native Mandarin speakers, readers, computer scientists, linguists working on these problems and be able to mess with the code right there, right? So that makes sense. But any service that required anyone to register, log in, and leave a record, those services were offshore. Those services were held on servers, the same servers that we have. So to get to Gmail, to get to Google Book Search, to get to Google Scholar, to get to any of those important services, even YouTube, where you can register, people in China who use these services would have to go to the same servers we use, which meant that occasionally they were blocked, but they were safe. The Chinese government couldn't come knocking and say, by the way, we want all the data and email of this person, the way they could do it with any such business hosted in China. So that worked out great, I think. Now, Google was always at a competitive disadvantage in China because it would not do what Baidu did, which is present direct, simple searches and links to pirated music and movies. That's the number one thing Baidu does. Baidu also is, you know, takes advantage of nationalism. It's the homegrown web company that's kicking the butt of this big bad American company. I mean, that's a great story for the vast majority of people in China who are terribly supportive of the government. And as a result, Google found ways to make money, but, you know, it was slowly creeping up in the size of the market, but the total market was still pretty huge. I mean, 100 million people. You know, in a population where Google clearly had a much better representation among two very important groups. One, the cosmopolitan elite, the people who are involved in international banking, people who go to college and university in Europe or Canada or the United States, people who are interested in connecting with the outside world, usually for business reasons, but often for political reasons, religious reasons, whatever. Those folks tended to use Google over Baidu. Except when they wanted to get music. Now, the other segment of the Chinese internet user population that was sort of more Google than Baidu of late has been younger college-educated people. And there are more people than ever going to college now in China. So there was a sense that younger people found a lot of virtue in the vast array of Google services, as long as they were able to get to them. And in college, they, you know, one of the first things you learn in college in China is how to use VPN, you know, how to use proxy service, how to use proxy service to get a consistent connection with Google services and get the thoroughly unfiltered search results anyway, right? So that's kind of what they were looking at. So this is, by threatening to pull out of China, this is actually a major risk for them for a couple of reasons. One, it doesn't matter if they remain 30% of the market forever. 30% of a potential billion people is nothing to sneeze at. You can still sell a lot of ads that way, and maybe even a lot of phones to put some transition down. But so that's what's really at risk here. So, I mean, I've read a lot of blog posts from cynics saying, well, Google is failing and this is, they don't really mean anything with this because they're backing out because they're just the tail between the legs. They're just, they don't want to admit that they're losing. Well, it's not a race, right? You know, every paying customer is a paying customer. Every click is a click. So, so they weren't necessarily losing. But of course they would love to be the dominant search engine in any market. It just wasn't going to happen anytime in the next decade, but whatever. The reason that that this is important in a larger sense is that Google is making a stand for the internet itself. Yes. What we've discovered, what Google revealed, this is the other thing that's amazing about what happened. Google is the first company to speak openly about the level of attacks and the level of vulnerability that's true. And people who are involved in web security and server security have known this secret for a long time, that nothing is really secure. Now think about the anxiety going through the room as the top 10 people at Google discuss this issue. Are we willing to explain to the world not really secure, that Google Docs is not really secure? We already saw the Twitter hacking event with Google Docs, you know, sort of demonstrate that. So they're risking eroding the perception that they have been trying to put forth in their gamble on cloud computing, right? They're putting cloud computing at risk as well as that huge Chinese market by this move. The reason they're doing this is they find their current state of practice and environment in China untenable. They can't stand for this level of aggressive intrusion into their security. That's just not the sort of thing that would happen. Because imagine if they hadn't announced this, imagine if they hadn't gone public with this vulnerability, and 30, 60 days from now, some political dissident gets arrested and they come to his door with all his Gmails, all his Gmail mails. At that point, Google becomes as big a sinner, if not bigger, than Yahoo was for giving up that dissident.
And also, none of us trust our Gmail with Google.
That's
that
right.
Point. That's none true. None of us trust the cloud at that point, as you said.
So if that happens, if they hadn't gotten ahead of this and taken this stand, they knew they were risking monumental embarrassment, both within China and worldwide. Already, Google's taken a number of important reputation hits. They could not afford that kind of tragedy, nor did they want the blood of anybody. I mean, nobody.
But contrast it to Microsoft's response, which was essentially, "No, I don't think."
What's the problem?
I don't think we're being hacked. Are we being hacked?
Oh my gosh! If we want to do This Week in Microsoft,
I don't think we're being hacked.
It's just, I know. I mean, Microsoft is just so dumb in this entire.
But here's where Google really, by putting planting a flag in the sand, drawing a line in the sand, says, "Come on, Microsoft and Yahoo, put up or shut up now." And other American corporations. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say Google now has a foreign policy. In fact, in some ways, you could say this is a fit of pique. You know, they talk about in the Computer World article, which is a great article, about a Christmas Eve meeting that Larry Page led to kind of discuss this. And the reaction was, holy crap, the malware is accessing our internal intercept system. And I think the first reaction from people like Larry and engineers is, screw you, China. You know, I mean, I could kind of understand that.
Okay.
Well, so I think Steve is right. I think, well said, Steve, that as usual, we don't disagree as much as it appears, that the new world here is the internet, and Google is what? Great Britain.
Well,
and it is the protector of this.
Right.
And I want to go back to one point you said before, though, Steve. I think where we do disagree is on the idea of corporate responsibility. I just put up on the wiki a piece by Umair Haque at the Harvard Business School blog, where Umair has been arguing very, very eloquently that basically Google's don't be evil case, that that is a business strategy today, that in an age when we can all talk about a company in an instant, doing evil is bad business.
But it also begs the question why they've been there for 4 years.
That's exactly it, right.
They've always been not happy about it. And Brin supposedly has not been happy about it. And so this is, I think the argument that this is really about the cyber attacks, it's a convenient way to bring up the censorship and to also try to make that the issue is a nice.
So gave them a hook. Benefit. Gave them a hook to do something they should have done 4 years ago.
Right. Yes. Okay. I mean, I don't want to argue too much about this, but look, basically, I don't buy that there was a free speech motivation at the core of this, because Google could have made a similar move in early December 2009 if it really were about free speech. It could have made it in 2007 if it were about free speech. No, it was really about the fact that the security and integrity of the internet and e-commerce is directly threatened by this.
That's what it felt like.
That includes free speech.
Yeah, but it looked like to me, well, we can deal with these guys until they start, you know, stealing stuff from us. Okay, now they've gone too far.
Exactly. So, but putting that aside, the real challenge, I mean, look at that. I tried to imagine what they want out of this, right? First of all, it's a total bluff and maybe even, oh, it's a total bluff. That's all.
You think there's an expectation? They have an expectation that China might change its law and allow them.
No. Listen, it's not a total bluff that they'll pull out of China. It's a total bluff that they will run an unfiltered, uncensored web search project in China, in Google.cn. It's absolutely a total bluff.
Let me clarify this, though. They're not yet doing that. What they said in the blog post is, we're going to give you two choices, China. You either change the law so that we can run an unfiltered search, or we leave. And you say that first choice is not even
total bluff. And so, like, it was weird because the first day that this broke, there were all sorts of people tweeting and blogging about the fact that, oh, now you can see Tank Man on Google.cn.
No,
I never looked for it, so I don't know. But the point was,
if you're searching from within the U.S. But
right. But so, look, they haven't uncensored anything, and they're not going to, because the moment that they go censor free, that's the point at which Chinese soldiers arrest every Google employee in the office. Right.
And do we know if that office is still open? They have the beautiful new offices in Beijing. Is that office still open?
I saw it on TechCrunch. You could take it or leave it. It was on TechCrunch that they Google had given them the long weekend, right? The MLK weekend off. And you know,
now a lot of them have to be Chinese citizens, which means they're not going anywhere.
Right. But still, you don't want to keep everybody in one place where it's easy to confiscate all the computers, all the servers, all the logs, and all the people at the same time, right? You may want to make it a little bit more challenging, but basically Google does not want to put its employees at risk. Google does not want to put its infrastructure at risk. It is willing to put its revenue at risk, and because there's a bigger battle to be fought here. Now, what Google would like with this threat to pull out is two things. One, that class of Google users who deeply love Google, and there's a story in the New York Times, I think coming out tomorrow, sort of interviewing a number of these people, the educated elites, the folks who are really sort of deeply into all the different Google products. You know, Google's hoping that there is some sort of, dare we say, rising political sensibility attached to this. I really doubt that people love Google enough to put their lives at risk. And I really doubt that China is liberal enough today to even create space for that. Nonetheless, seeding that dissatisfaction can be really important over the long run. But more importantly, I think Google desperately wanted to force the hand of Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and various European leaders so that they stand up and say, you know what? China's activities in this area are threatening a major area of global commerce and a major segment of the European and American economy and the trust that we all hope to have in the internet in the future. That is major. And there, because so far the United States government under Obama has been meek dealing with China, not willing to challenge them on a number of issues, I think Google felt it didn't have a choice, even though Eric Schmidt could pick up the phone and talk to the president. It didn't have a choice without going public.
Well, isn't Secretary Clinton speaking on Thursday on this? I mean,
was going to be a fuzzy speech about internet freedom, blah, 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 you know, flowers and puppies. But now it actually has to be grounded in something that directly takes on the Chinese government. And that is big.
And they did already say, you know, hands off or whatever. I can't remember. Exactly. Get your fingers out of our servers. Right.
Google succeeded in making sure that the United States government is on record about this issue and is taking it seriously.
She does say that the State Department was briefed by Google. So, Google has access.
And I'm sure there's much more going on behind the scenes that we'll never know about.
Here's the quote from Secretary Clinton. She says, "We look to the Chinese government for an explanation." That's harsh words. "The ability to cooperate with confidence in cyberspace is critical in a modern society and economy."
We didn't say this about dangerous products that were killing people.
Yeah, lead, no.
Finally standing up to China.
That was a different Secretary of State. So, let's put it.
That's true.
That's a funny thing Jim Fallows says is that China is entering its Bush-Cheney era.
Yeah,
in which they're pissing off their foreign allies with their policies.
Well, but not for the first time. But let's also remember, I mean, Jeff and I had this really neat sort of back and forth on our blogs about this notion of the extent to which Google is behaving like a state. But so historically, though, let's be clear, this isn't radically new that British East India Company acted like a state, and basically colonized India and Indonesia. The Dutch East India Company, I'm sorry, colonized Indonesia the same way, right? Acted like a state with many of the powers of the state, employing privateers to do warfare, to actually go, and lots of, basically raising their own private armies to do these sorts of activities. So it's not new that companies, multinational companies doing work around the globe have foreign policies and actually military policies. So that's actually been a longstanding thing. When Rockefeller ran Standard Oil, he had a foreign policy as he went beyond North America looking for oil. Today, ExxonMobil has a foreign policy, and many of them, in fact. So none of that's radically new. Coca-Cola, of course, has its own version of foreign policy, one that's light enough we don't even notice. So that's not necessarily the new thing. The interesting thing about Google is that because so many of the challenges of sort of reining in or maybe civilizing or making the internet work well for everyday people, those challenges, fighting spyware, fighting malware, making sure that the cacophony of information available out there is usable and navigable. These are questions of governance. And because no state or group of states or coalition of states is either authorized or capable of engaging in this level of governance.
Or trusted to,
Google is filling that vacuum.
So you say it's supranational. And is essentially
what Steve said is it's the governance of the internet.
Right.
And some may, get uncomfortable with that wording, but I think he's right. I think that's...
I can't get away from the notion, though, that Google didn't care until their servers were broken into.
Well,
I think
they cared.
True, Leo, but they did care. I think there was an argument going on inside the company. The word is, and I have no inside knowledge on this, but the word is that Sergey Brin has been uncomfortable since the first. I linked to a quote of his in 2006 in which he was clearly uncomfortable.
It's clear, that's good PR. One of our principals is uncomfortable, but we're still going to do it.
even if it's true, it doesn't matter. What really matters is effects in the real world, right? So, I mean, William James said, a belief is that upon which you are willing to act.
Yes.
And basically, Google was
for 4 years not willing to act on it. So that's why I am a little suspect of the whole thing. I applaud them. I think one of the reasons they're doing it is because to the outside world, where there's mounting suspicion of Google, they needed some way to say, oh, look, see.
Well, they needed virtue.
They needed virtue. But the timing's very convenient for that. So
I think that's truly, but that doesn't take away what, Yahoo hasn't done it. Microsoft hasn't done it. Cisco hasn't done it.
No, it's the right thing to do. I'm not saying it's not the right thing to do. I'm saying it was the right thing to do 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I understand the need. Look, if you're eBay, you don't sell Nazi memorabilia in Germany, whether you agree with that law or not. You have to follow the laws of the nation. So the choice is not whether to do it or not. The choice is whether to participate in that country's economy. And that's where I think maybe Google could have said 4 years ago, no. And I think that would have had equal power and would have put the same kind of challenge to Yahoo and Microsoft then.
But Leo,
what are you hearing in technology circles from people? Is this resonating as a big issue, or is it more on the blather sphere?
I mean, I think everyone's really happy and excited about what happened. I mean, I think that I too am stuck like Leo on this idea that they made the announcement after realizing the attacks and the surveillance. I mean, I think that this is very much like a geek ego thing. Google couldn't stand the idea
they were hacked.
They were hacked and that their servers were in a building somewhere in China and possibly wiretapped. I mean, you know, then later on that week, I don't know if this is related, but it's interesting that later on that week, HTTPS, the encrypted version of Gmail, becomes
turned on
by default. So, you know, I think that this
too.
Is, it is about time. It is about time. You could turn it on before, but it's about time that it was just the default. So, which is interesting because security then becomes more important than speed, because encryption speed is a tiny bit slower. You really don't feel it, but so, yeah, I mean, I really think that this was just a matter of ego. They couldn't swallow the idea that they were actually enabling, you know, the Chinese government to find dissidents, you know, to find information about those people.
And they're right to be up in arms, but
they should. Yeah, but that's how it changed. I mean, that's the thing that changed the game.
But it's
a little bit
like saying we're going to do business with Nazi Germany, selling them guns. Oh my goodness, they're harming Jews. Oh well, we'll get out now. It's like, yeah, well, that's good now. But come on, what happened 4 years ago? I still don't. Yeah.
Leo, I think it is different in scale. It's very different in scale.
People aren't getting. Well, I don't know. Maybe they are getting killed. I don't know.
People are getting let
Gina finish. Hold on a second. Let me let Gina finish.
I mean the point that Google was attacked and some information was there was a security breach is a big threat to their business, right? I mean, they want to convince the whole world that storing your information in the cloud is secure. So here's an example when it wasn't, for whatever reasons. And I think, you know, Douglas Rushkoff wrote an article saying that this was a PR move to cover up what was a security breach. And I think I've said this in past shows. All Google needs is one major, well-publicized security breach to set back their cloud business, you know, years and years.
Why wasn't this it?
Well, this wasn't it, because they turned it into, you know, what could be perceived as a brilliant PR move.
Rushkoff calls it the great Google cover-up.
Yes. So you have lots of people cheering them on. Yay, Google's doing the right thing. But, you know, they got into people's Gmail accounts.
Right.
What does that mean?
But enlightened self-interest is not a bad thing. I agree with you. I think that I think Siva is right, and I think you are agreeing with him, that the cloud was at risk, thus Google was at risk, the internet was at risk. And who was doing it? A regime, a dictator, mm-hmm. a tyrannical dictator that's been putting out products that kill people, killing people for their views, imprisoning for their views, and we never stood up. Why? Because we're all so damn greedy, we don't want to pass up the market.
Right.
And so, you know, yes, Leo, they should have done it 4 years ago. I said it at the time. I've said it since. Sometimes we all have to make mistakes and then come to our damn senses, and I'm glad somebody did.
Yeah, and I think we're all applauding Google for coming to their senses.
I would say, though, that Google was not complicit in the imprisoning of anyone, the exploitation of anyone, the murder of anyone.
Unlike Yahoo.
And Google was careful about that. And it, not only because they're human beings, and who would really want to, unless you want to absolve yourself of all responsibility, but more than that, they also knew that at post-Yahoo, it was an impossible business relationship to do on those same terms, to keep the sensitive information on China just in China. It just would have been madness. So they learned a lot from what Yahoo did. So I think that it would have been corporate malpractice not to do business in China. Every major American company does business in China. Nike employs people in sweatshops in China.
Every iPod we've got, in fact, probably this Google phone, is made in China.
Exactly. Look, if you have a problem, this is one of the big arguments in my book, and the other side of the corporate responsibility dismissal is basically corporations are legally bound to basically be immoral, to be amoral, to be interested in the interests of their stockholders, and period, right? Basically, period. So,
do you read Umar Hake on that, Siva?
I'm sorry.
Umar's argument is that, again, now that we can all talk about a company in a flash, that being evil is going to affect your business, that it becomes part of your enlightened self-interest.
That's right.
And that being good,
I don't disagree with
you
that
have a fiduciary responsibility to your stakeholders to be a good company.
I don't disagree at all. But what that deflates, he agrees with me, because what that deflates is a sense that corporate responsibility is somehow distinct from self-interest.
And that's, well, and maybe that's what this is a manifestation of. Now, Rushkoff raises a specter that I think is important, which is we don't know how much Google was cooperating with China.
Yeah, I think Rushkoff's full of crap for a couple of reasons. I mean, generally, he's on the ball about a lot of things. First of all, he gets completely wrong a major fact in his piece. One, he says that Google has servers with sensitive information within the People's Republic of China. That is absolutely not true. And that was the key to Google's strategy 5 years ago. Nobody would be stupid enough to defy the policy as outlined to Congress under oath, right, about this sort of thing. So that was absolutely untrue. Rushkoff's also surmising that Google's close interaction with the government created these vulnerabilities. What we've seen from the security researchers so far, and we've had very little clarity on this, was that basically the vulnerabilities were, surprise, surprise, Microsoft Internet Explorer vulnerabilities, which, you know, were exploited, and maybe to some degree some Adobe PDF vulnerabilities. Again, not a surprise.
But that was for the human rights activists worldwide who got hacked. Was that for Google as well?
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
So, you know, they're just, I mean, but again, we don't know exactly. Well, okay, I don't know. I don't know. Nobody knows for sure.
Right.
But in addition, a lot of these vulnerabilities, a lot of sort of backdoors in a lot of these systems are actually required under U.S. law to allow the NSA and the FBI into backdoors. Again, not very well expressed or understood. So in a lot of ways, the government we tend to trust helps make a lot of these servers insecure and opens up potential vulnerabilities. That's one possibility. But saying that Google basically was in bed with the Chinese government requires either a complete invocation of a falsehood, which is what he did, or a reaction to the absence of evidence, right? The absence of evidence.
No, it's pure speculation. Obviously, it's pure speculation.
Yeah, but it's irresponsible.
But it raises, I don't know if it's irresponsible. I think it raises an interesting point. We don't know.
No, it's worse because without any evidence I remember during the Iraq war, there were bloggers who were in Iraq who were in favor of U.S. policy. They've all actually switched around, but at the time they were. And there were people who went on the air who speculated they were CIA with absolutely no evidence and could have killed them as a result.
Right.
And I think that it is just plain, I mean, as a journalist, it is just plain irresponsible.
Well, is
on the basis of a guess, to then come to all these conclusions.
Well, but is it irresponsible to point out, and I won't go as far as Doug, but is it irresponsible to point out that we don't really know to what degree
just for the negative. We don't really know that Google didn't cause.
Everybody's assuming.
Prove to me that Google didn't cause HIV.
No, I understand. You can't prove a negative, but everybody's assuming that Google, kept China at arm's length. But we don't know how whether they did or not, do we?
I mean, so we know for sure that there were no Google servers in China, even just serving search results.
Well, as Siva was saying, there were some servers there.
There were some servers there. That's what you're saying, Siva.
But only for search. Only for Google.cn.
Here was because the email was here.
Right.
Right, Siva?
So Gmail was kept here.
So Gmail was here. Any apps that you had to sign in to access and use were located in, like, Texas, right? But there were some search servers in China. See, I thought that Doug was saying that China, because there were servers in China, even the ones just serving search results, that they could have been just... You know, tap the wires and
watch. Well, here's what we don't know. I mean, as a programmer and as a geek, that those servers were certainly connected to Google servers in the States and could have provided a portal to those servers in the States. We don't know. We don't have any information about what happened, really.
Right.
We just don't know. And you have to trust Google to tell us what, you know, happened. And let's be honest, when a bank gets broken into, they don't tell you what happened.
Not until they close it up.
Until it's done. So we don't know, but you're right. You can't prove the negative. So I think maybe it's irresponsible to promulgate a conspiracy theory, but I'm not convinced by Google at this point. It seems like it was more of a fit of pique because they got hacked into than any commitment to human rights. And I think the timing is very convenient for Google. It gives them a chance to say, look, see how good we are. It distracts from the fundamental issue of how secure they are.
Look at it another way then. Fine. Then Google could not attack China for the attacks and hold China to a moral standard.
They can.
And not bring up censorship. In that sense, Google was forced to bring up censorship.
No.
Because if they turned around and said, nasty, nasty, you Chinese, how dare you do this? The response kind of, A, they have no proof, so you're in Rushkoff territory. And B, it puts them in a delicate ethical position because they are conspiring with the Chinese to the extent of censoring results.
Yeah.
But censorship.
By the way, I just got a tweet from Simon at Illuminant, who puts up a link I will put up on the wiki, saying that here's evidence that the Tiananmen Square stuff was up on a Google.cn search on 15 January.
Simon's in our chat room and says that he's coming in from a U.S. IP address, but he says that he has employees in China and uses LogMeIn to check those Chinese servers. So it's I don't know whether you can.
I don't know either. I just put it up.
I don't know.
And well, stuff can appear and get indexed by Google.cn within a day and not get scrubbed immediately. That's always possible too. It's, you know, there are lots of different ways things can happen, can pop up.
I too saw these images from Google.cn that showed the protester and so forth. But you just don't know.
I need to make two points. One, search result censorship is trivial. That's not the sort of censorship that really makes a difference in people's lives. Most of the folks who want illicit material, whether it's pornography or Falun Gong material or democratic activists, they are going to use proxy servers, use VPN. They're going to find ways to do it. It's not hard to do. The knowledge is easy to get once you're in those groups. Now, it's nice. It's much better. Makes us feel better as narcissistic Westerners to think that free speech is going to change the world instantly. But in fact, what really matters is the flesh and bones issue, the fact that China tortures people, imprisons people without charge. And that the real human body's at risk. That's what the human rights question was. And ultimately, what the real threat to and by any internet company was. I just saw a tweet saying, my Twitter address, please stay off Twitch shows with your garbage Republican rants.
Republican?
Yeah, Republican. Right. I mean, like, this clearly.
Oh, just ignore these nitwits. I should always warn anybody who comes on our show that no matter who you are, you will get some nitwit saying something because you're in public now. Welcome. Welcome to the general public. They're a lovely bunch. I hope you enjoy them.
When is your Republican book coming out, Siva?
Are you a Republican, Siva? Because we don't allow Republicans on this show.
You know, I'm a Republican with a small R and that sort of...
You have a Republican haircut. That's for the extra.
Yeah, right.
Ah, if I'd only known, I tell you.
Oh, wow. Well, no, anyway, I think the fascinating thing here, like, we can unpack motives, whatever. The fascinating thing here is there's some major stuff going down here. We have big, important companies standing up, at least one in the lead, several others joining behind, standing up to this dirty little secret that the Chinese government has been actively disrupting some of the core functions of the internet and of e-commerce. And we are going to see in the next few weeks whether the United States takes this seriously and puts its relationship with China at risk because of it. And over the long term, we're going to see whether the cosmopolitan elite in China actually can forge some sort of political identity, because all of the big political conflicts in China over the past 20 years have been largely on the margins of China, in the Western provinces with the Uyghurs,
right,
in Tibet and so forth. We've not seen an uprising since 1989 in places like Shanghai and Beijing. This wouldn't be the trigger by no means, or, you know, is a search engine company going to create a new demonstration, but a sense of political consciousness and potential, because good things that the elites who have been winning so much in China are suddenly in danger because of the quirks of the Chinese government, that could help feed into a sense of sort of, you know, middle to upper middle class political consciousness within China.
I think there are probably moderate forces in fact, I know there are moderate forces in the Chinese Politburo. And there are extreme forces, and there is a very delicate balance between them. And something as little as this can actually shift those forces. So it might not be protests in the streets. It might be something that's completely invisible that happens in the highest ranks of government, where the moderates
might make a big difference.
It might make a huge difference. The moderates might say, "See, we're running the risk of getting cut off from the rest of the world by this policy, maybe we ought to think about it. I'll tell you, you know, when I was in China in July, one of the things that's really apparent in Beijing is and I talked to a lot of Chinese nationals about filtering of the internet and censorship and so forth. And they, of course, said, yeah, anybody can get around it if they want to. We don't really care. Some people said, oh, you know, they're mostly just filtering pornography. That's fine. And I think one of the reasons you don't see protests in the streets is there's this general sense of prosperity and progress right now in the cities of China. And I think as long as that continues, I think a lot of the people there feel like, well, we'll get there. And we're making progress. I mean, it's a lot better than it was under Mao. It's a lot better than it was 20 years ago. So maybe they're not quite so revolutionary as, say, the people in Iran.
Gina, what we've learned so far about the this is a question for Gina, for the other attacks on other companies, was China just going after dissidents, or was China going after the internet for the rest of us?
That's a good question, yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I actually haven't read a whole lot. I saw a couple of headlines that Windows 7 or like that one of the bugs that was exploited was in like all the versions of Windows. But I'm not sure exactly what the other have other companies published information about these attacks.
Just
as well?
Adobe, which is just an Adobe? Odd company to have been hacked.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Once again, regardless of what happens, once again, Google is first to market. Not this time with Strata, but this time with a decision. Now, so like if other U.S. companies do follow suit, say Microsoft and Yahoo both come out and say, we're going to do the same thing, that they're just going to look like Me Toos, which is really like Google's strategy all the time, it seems like, is to make these sort of, you know, whatever, new products or revolutionary kind of stands right away. And then anyone who tries to follow them, I mean, with the exception of Android, right? Because the iPhone was first. But, you know,
well,
Google Docs...
Well, it could be Steve Jobs since his phones are made there.
Yeah.
Well, everything just, Apple makes is made there, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if other companies do what Google did. I mean, in one way, it's like, do you want to look like the Me Too? Do you want to kind of come out and say, well, we didn't have the guts to do this first, but now that they did, we will? I don't know.
You know,
I don't know.
Here's an interesting point, which is that about 6 months ago, it became out that it was believed to be the Chinese government had hacked the electrical grid in the U.S. and that many private electrical providers had Trojans on their system that appear to have been put there by the Chinese government. And instead, there was no hue and cry. Secretary Clinton didn't say, well, you got some splaining to do. It just kind of went over quietly. And I think until Google kind of made this big stink, it was something that the feds could kind of say, well, you know, we know what's going on, you know. But apparently, according to some, these kinds of spear phishing attacks that were going after human rights advocates have been going on for 3 years. And what's interesting, according to iDefense, which is a security firm, that many of these attacks were going after source code. That, yeah. For instance, the attack on Adobe was for source code.
Well, that's what makes me say that this is more than just...
This is economic espionage.
Precisely.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, look, the idea of corporate espionage is not new, well, to the world, but not new to China either. And being able to get into Adobe's servers could certainly serve Chinese software companies quite well, could serve the Chinese military quite well. Understanding Adobe's encryption could serve both interests quite well. And look, the Chinese military is heavily involved with a lot of major industries in China. I mean, right down to the pressing of DVDs.
Oh, absolutely.
Press DVDs, the army's involved.
They
right?
own so, hotels, everything, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, you know, you have, while you have the internet threatened and internet security threatened and the cloud threatened and maybe even Amazon and eBay threatened down the line, what is on top of that is the trade secrets of so many major American companies. One of the companies listed in the New York Times the other day that had been a victim of this was a defense contractor, right? Which should not be surprising. If you were the Chinese government and had the ability to breach some systems, you would want Northrop Grumman. You know, you'd want to get some airplane engine information. It's, you know, it's such a huge problem. But again, that's what's so fascinating about it. This is why this is, I think, going to be one of the biggest stories of the next 3 years. This is not going to go away soon.
But it's not even a new story. Remember the GhostNet attacks we heard about last year against the Dalai Lama? These are the same techniques, the same technology, the same controlling servers. So it's, I mean, I think it's very interesting because this has been going on, we know, for since 2001, according to F-Secure, for 9 years. But now Google raises the issue and suddenly it's a story. It does, in fact, kind of underscore what you said, Jeff, that Google is now kind of extra national, you know?
Well, that's what Die Zeit was saying in Germany was, look, Germany and the U.S. didn't have the, pardon me, cojones.
We didn't do anything. We just said,
And Google, you know, fine, 31% of the market, but it has less to lose. And I think if SIVA's, the question is, if that middle class, if that intelligentsia does start to feel empowered by this and feel that someone in the world is going to back them up, that's the key. Someone in the world will back us up. Then what will they do? Will it be like the Kurds in Iraq with the first Bush? Or, you know, what will happen to people who do try to stand up on behalf of human rights in China? Right now, there's, you know, beyond the occasional, oh, you shouldn't do that protest, and then let's do some more business, guys.
And just in case you needed some more encouragement, one of the security experts from IT Harvest said, my message to everybody is you are all under attack. You are all under attack. This is going on in very widespread fashion.
Thing. Is it in China's interest to hurt the internet?
It says, these attacks demonstrate a shift with the Chinese now brazenly going after U.S. industry interests. The Defense Group Incorporated says they've gone from attacking the military and defense such that it benefited their state in national security to striking the heart of the American technology economy.
And I hate to get, you know, now I'll be accused of being Republican, but Al-Qaeda is rooting them on.
Al-Qaeda doesn't have the sophistication, though. This is what's really interesting.
They're jealous as hell.
China has the sophistication to do this. And I think what you're seeing is it's hardliners in China. And maybe if the world gets upset and finally stands up to this, maybe starting with Google, I'd love to see Microsoft and Yahoo come along.
There are those. This goes to modernity. It goes to those who think that the internet is a bad thing because the internet takes away control.
It's a good thing because it lets us invade your systems. I don't think they're trying to shut down the internet. They love this.
Yeah. Nobody's more modern than Chinese. The Chinese just want the internet on their terms.
Yeah.
Internet is not forever
the internet.
There's nothing.
I could even go farther and say it's not about filtering at this point.
It's about the very definition of the internet. It is the constitution of the internet that we're fighting
over. I agree with you there, but I won't go as far as modernity. I mean, it's really it's a different vision of how things should be laid out. But, you know, look, the Chinese government would love, you know, everybody to be totally wired just
under
not
their terms.
I think this is them being economically very aggressive and competitive and saying we're gonna steal your stuff. We're going to make it better than you.
The great irony to me is that we attack China as a amoral communist country when China has become the most capitalist country there is.
I've said that for a long time.
Set of standards.
If you want to worry about capitalism, run riot.
You're watching it.
You just wait till 1 billion Chinese say, "Okay, here we come," because absolutely.
And that's why the idea that no matter what the cause. If the rationale and discussion is about evil and ethics, I'm glad for that. But it's not purely about, even though it is enlightened self-interest, there's an enlightenment involved. And I think that's very important for the discussion.
I think it was Bill Gross who said that China slept through the Industrial Revolution. They've woken up in the IT revolution and they're not going to miss this boat. They may have a different opinion about how to run it, but they're not going to miss this boat. We're going to move on to topic two. There doesn't really need to be a topic two on this one, but we promised we would talk about the Nexus One phone.
And where is it made?
In China, I'm sure. Well, it doesn't say, but I'm sure it's in China. It's made by HTC. I don't know.
Yeah.
So Jeff, now I'm going to say even more strongly than I did last week. And you've given it some time, I hope. But this phone, in my opinion, knocks the socks off the iPhone. It is simply the best phone I've ever used. Gina, wow. Gina, you're gonna back me up on this one?
Well, of course. But wait a second now. But you were the one in
you
the middle.
You two conspired.
Yo.
I know.
I was in the middle because I hadn't used it yet. I, you know, mine was waiting for me at home.
But wait a second. So, Leo, you, this is your phone now? Like, this is your primary phone?
Do you, you see an iPhone anywhere in here?
Welcome.
It's finally good enough, and I'll tell you, in some ways it's better. The screen is spectacular. Not great in daylight because OLED doesn't do well in daylight, but it's a, when I go back to the iPhone, it just feels blurry and washed out and just
That's great. The UI
with the five pages, and I used your folders trick, which basically gives the UI unlimited pages, right? Now we can
look at that smug grin on Gina's face.
that's a great tip, and if you missed that, listen to Twig last week, which by the way was late coming out because of CES, and I think our editors, and in fact if you're watching live, I think it's still not out, but we'll get it out before we get this one out. I just love the widgeting. There's some great widgets on here. I think Google has enhanced its applications. Now, I did get the straight scoop on multi-touch.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I got an email from inside Google. You're going to love this. And now, again, it's unsourced. It's inside Google and blah, blah, blah. But I do believe it's inside Google. He said, Apple asked us not to implement multi-touch just yet. In the U.S., because Apple knows its patents for multi-touch are very weak and doesn't want to contest them at this point. So Apple, which apparently still has very good relationships with Google over everything except phones, you know, said, hey, you know, Eric, dude.
Couldn't Google have licensed multi-touch from Apple?
Yeah, that might have been one way to do it. But the truth is multi-touch is in here. The Milestone does do multi-touch, the Droid in Europe, that the OS supports it. And in fact, the guy who sent it to me said, I could prove multi-touch is in there. Press Shift and P at the same time on your keyboard. And in fact, there are a number of applications available, including a browser that support multi-touch on here. So it's just that the Google apps don't have multi-touch enabled. It is on the phone. And I expect it'll be enabled fully as soon as Apple... I don't know, does what? Licenses it to Google or whatever it is to avoid the court case. But that's all that's missing on here is multi-touch. And I think in many ways, for instance, the gallery application, which is much improved in 2.1 and pulls from Picasa, is spectacular. If it had multi-touch, it'd be the best photo application out there. The camera is great. It's a much better camera than the iPhone. In fact, it's as good as the N95 or the N900. It's a great 5-megapixel camera. I'm blown away by this.
What network do you use, Leo?
It's T-Mobile, but you know where I am, T-Mobile's okay. I have HSDPA and I have, you know, it's decent connectivity. It frankly, it's better than AT&T here. Doesn't drop calls as much.
Leo, I would imagine you have your own cell tower in the backyard.
Well, did I mention that? T-Mobile did put one out there. So, no. I've had good results with T-Mobile. I think when this is out on Verizon, which I'm told it will be March 23rd, the first day of spring 2010. This will be the best phone in America. So Jeff, how's your experience? Have you
done?
Are you come along? Are you coming along?
I'm coming along. I'm being pissy.
No, be pissy. That's somebody's got a dissent here.
Talk to us.
So I have a whole list of questions for Gina.
Okay.
Let me see. Where do I start here? The first thing that's driving me a little nutty about it is I cannot turn off all the friggin' notifications, and I can't tell what it's notifying me about. It's you know, buzzing again, and I have no idea. I'm trying to turn them off all over. You have to do it application by application. I have no idea.
It took me a little while to figure this out, Jeff. I'm with you, but I love the notification system on Android, and you can totally control it, so you have different sounds for each program. I have Twitteroid that does a tweet when I get a direct message. My email makes a different sound. My text message makes a different sound.
I want none. I can't turn them off.
Or you can turn them
off. Jeff, you found the window shade, right? So, like, if you pull and drag down, you'll get the details of what the notifications mean.
Oh, see, this is why.
Oh, you didn't know about that?
Tap and drag this down. This is one of the coolest things that Android has over the iPhone. You know how the iPhone's notifications are just these kind of modal pop-ups, and you have to dismiss them one by one.
Notification.
Yeah,
but I only have two on here, and it's been buzzing at me like every 10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So if you pull down the window shade, just check out to see what are they. Is it is it seismic? Is it your Gmail? And then or is it Google Voice? And then you just need to go into each application in the settings and say notify me. Yes. No. Maybe seismic. You can say notify me for DMs, but not for at replies, or notify me for all. You just have to calibrate it. And I agree. When you first set up an Android phone, often the notifications come so so, you know, so much, and the phone buzzes so much that it gets overwhelming. It's just a matter of configuring.
But you can totally configure it, and it's a per application setting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love the unified email box in this. It's great. I mean, this is something the iPhone doesn't do. Just put
I don't think the email is as good as the iPhone app. I mean, I want to be able to. It's again, it's not using the gestures enough, I think. And the main app doesn't put conversations together. And the Gmail app, I don't think is as good here as it is.
The main app does, and I would use the main app. Threaded conversations. I see what you're saying. Right. Yeah, that is a nice feature, and I wish
it did. It's weird that it doesn't operate like Google Mail in the Google phone. The Gmail app, I think, is a little weak.
What don't you like about the Gmail app? Because that's actually one of my main reasons for being on Android as well.
Silly stuff. Being able to read more on it. I wish that I could use gestures more to do things like kill. I've got to open. I can mark them and kill them. Getting to boxes. Do I know how to do that? Yeah. How do I get the other mailboxes?
There's two ways. There's the Gmail app itself, and then you just hit you hit the menu item at the bottom. You know, the button at the bottom with the lines is the settings.
That far. And go into how do I get into other mailboxes? How do I get into my outbox or my sent box from there?
Oh, I see what you mean. Other mailboxes. Okay, so just it's labels. So hit that menu button and then choose view labels. Yeah, because you know in Gmail,
Google engineer.
Gmail everything is a label.
Yeah, that's one thing I didn't like about Gmail is the focus on labels.
This is helping me immensely. All right. Next, my Seismic thinks that it's 19 hours ago at all times.
I would buy Twidroid Pro. I know a lot of people like Seismic, but Twidroid Pro to me is so much more customizable. I can have multiple accounts, control the notifications. So, for instance, Seismic will notify you for everything. Twidroid, you can just say, oh, look, email just forced closed. That's been happening a lot for me. That's the only application.
That's another question. How do I kill an app? Because sometimes I just want to kill the app, and I can't figure out how to do that.
Yeah, I don't know what you do, Gina, but I got the Advanced Task Manager, which I really like on here.
If you go into settings, so you go to the menu, so you tap the menu, and you go to settings, and you go to applications, you can see a list of running services.
Thank you. There, you've done it again, Gina.
And you can quit any one of them from there. Some applications have the option to quit inside of its own settings. Like Seismic, you can go into Seismic settings and there's a quit option. I think it's buried in like the more menu. But if there's a process running on your phone that's like sucking up a lot of battery, and you can see that too because Android will list the biggest battery hogs. You know, I'll say your phone's been on for 4 hours and your display has used this percentage of battery. That's also in settings. Let's see.
I think it's in the running services in applications, isn't it? Does that show you battery life? No. I actually downloaded and use a task manager, which lets me just kind of mass kill everything. And I do that from time to time.
If you go into settings, about phone, battery use.
Oh, that's handy.
So my display has taken up 82% of the battery. My live wallpapers has taken up 7%. Live wallpapers are cool, but they eat CPU. You can see a whole list there.
That's nice.
Okay, that's good. All right, I'm getting there on my list. This is beautiful. I'm going to be taking communion shortly.
I mean, let's just say in Android there are many submenus and there's lots of tapping.
Yeah, it's quite really hard to get the logic of it. Speaking of logic, here's my main thing. Give me a worldview so I understand the difference between the home screens, the little hash mark screens, the idea of a folder, the idea of a widget, what's a shortcut. I'm just confused about the structure of this, and I think it's simpler than I am giving it credit for. But there's some elegant logic here that I'm not seeing.
Yeah. So you use a Mac, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, the Android paradigm is much different from the iPhone paradigm, and for these reasons, and I think this is why people who use the iPhone who try Android at first are just totally put off. The Android paradigm is very similar to your desktop computer. There's your desktop, which in Android terms are the home screens. Those are the screens that you see when you kind of swipe to left to right. And then there's the menu, which would be the equivalent, the menu when you tap the menu button, that little button that looks like a grid, that shows you everything that's installed in the phone. That's the equivalent as if you had an applications folder stack on your Mac's dock and you click it, or if you just go to the applications folder, it shows you every single thing that's installed in the phone. So the point of having both the applications menu and the home screens. It's just the same reason why you have a desktop on your desktop computer and an applications list. The home screens give you the opportunity to put shortcuts to the things that you use the most, so you don't have to scroll through the whole, you know, applications menu every time. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Okay, now, so then if I hold down on the home screen and I, let's say, hit shortcut, I get a very limited list of a few things. I don't understand that function. The way to do a shortcut is just to hold down on the app in the grid thing.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it. Right? That's faster, yeah.
So there's nothing special about this shortcut.
No. And that, by the way, works best with Gina's folder tip because you can hold it down and drag it to a folder directly. So if you want to add something to a folder, you just hold it down and drag it into the folder. Right. And it works great.
The add to home screen shortcuts dialog. So if you tap and hold your wallpaper, you get that add to home screen. That also is pretty hierarchical. So you only get a few choices. You get shortcuts, widgets, folders, wallpapers. But then you drill down into each.
There's a lot of kinds of shortcuts, for instance.
Yeah, there's a lot of different kinds of shortcuts.
It's worth investigating this. I think widgets are fantastic. I've even downloaded a few extra widgets because this is something that's lacking on the iPhone. The ability to put, for instance, a big Facebook widget that gives you status updates, or this widget that goes with the Google News and Weather application, or even just a big weather and clock application. This is something missing from the iPhone. I love having the calendar right there that I can tap on it and see the calendar. I think they've done a nice job with the widgets.
We're going to put a shortcut, for example, to get right to the Wi-Fi settings without having to go through the three layers.
Here's what I would... There's a set of widgets called Beautiful Widgets that are really great. I use those all the time. And there's a number of them, beautiful Bluetooth, GPS, plain mode, silent. You can actually have a beautiful Wi-Fi, which will put a widget that you can just turn on or off there. But there's also a larger widget. I bet Gina uses this. It comes with on the phone where you get all of these wireless connections. So I've turned off Bluetooth to save battery life because I'm not in my car right now. Or I could change the screen. And that general one is a really...
You can't really adjust things there, but you can just turn them
on or off.
Toggles it on and off. So, Jeff, if you wanted to do a shortcut directly to Wi-Fi settings, you tap and hold on the home screen, and then you go to shortcuts, and then scroll down and choose settings, and then scroll down and choose Wi-Fi settings.
So you could take any setting and put it on there. That's cool. You could do that also with a phone number if you want to text somebody with one touch, or call somebody with one touch. That's cool.
And then just Wi-Fi settings at the bottom. And so now you have a one-click access to your Wi-Fi settings right
there.
That's
great. That's handy. That's a nice tip. Gina, you got to write a book on this. This is great.
Yeah, she should. She can do it in about a week, I think.
Yeah.
I got one odd thing. I tried to set up a Google Voice voicemail, and it told me your network carrier is not configured for voicemail.
Huh? Are you on
strange.
T-Mobile?
Yeah.
One of the things I love about this is I was able to replace T-Mobile's voicemail and everything with Google Voice. I just use Google Voice for the voicemail. It's my voicemail application. You're getting some weird anomaly there.
Okay, that's fine.
That's strange because when it prompted me, I just hit yes, set up voicemail, and it did it. Go to google.com/voice in a regular, browser, on your desktop, and then you can configure it there. You just have to give it, your T-Mobile number, and it'll do it for you.
One more question. What was it? Oh, my contacts. Is there any way to export my contacts from my Apple, from my Mac? Because that's where I have my phone number.
Do you have Snow Leopard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you go in your address book, you sync it with your Google account.
You can now. That's new.
That was something new in Snow Leopard.
I didn't have Snow Leopard.
Yep.
All right. Okay. So here's the story, guys. Thursday, I called the company and the instructions, and I got a return authorization code.
Oh, Jeff, you're breaking my heart.
That's where I am right now. You've done it.
I'll tell you.
I don't know if it's going to be my main phone because it's still not an iPhone.
Oh, it's to me.
It's still a little rough. It is.
I don't find it rough at all. I think that's mostly a mismatch between expectations. I find it very straightforward. Easy to use, and once you use it for a while, I find it more intuitive than the iPhone.
But you're still capable of using
it. Once you use it for a while. This is the thing. I think it has a learning curve that the iPhone just doesn't. And I think that the iPhone has sort of set expectations on what app phones should look like. So I think when someone switches from iPhone to Android, it's like, what is it? In fact, John Gruber has been cracking me up because someone gave him a Nexus One to play with, and he's been tweeting the most sort of sarcastic things about the Nexus One. You know, he's a total, you know, aesthete and loves Apple products. So it's kind of funny to listen to his impressions of Nexus One, like as he tries different things out.
I think that's bigotry. I think this is more elegant than the iPhone. Believe me, I'm open-minded, and I believe this is more elegant in every way than the iPhone.
What Gina just proved my point against you, Leo, I think, is that it's what I said, I think, last week, that Apple tries so hard to think like we do we don't have to think.
I feel constrained by the iPhone. The fact that I can only put an icon on the desktop is a huge constraint and really limits what I can do with the phone's display. Things
is
like that.
Is your Mustang a stick shift?
Yeah.
Yeah, you say, well, there it is.
No. I think the iPhone, if you use this phone for a month and went back to the iPhone, you would see what I'm seeing, which is the iPhone feels antiquated compared to this. I really feel like it's constrained compared to this. I really do, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, I believe.
Gina, have you seen this thing when you press and hold the button? I love this. There's a few things in 2.1 I really like. These little ellipses on the left and right that let me go. But if you press and hold, you get a thumbnail of the home screens.
No.
Oh, this is so slick.
I didn't see that. Wait a second. What button are you pressing?
So, you know, on the bottom of your phone, you have the ellipses that let you go to a different screen.
Right.
Yeah.
Press and hold it.
Oh, that's a new one to me.
Yes, that's new in 2.1. Isn't that slick?
See, that's the funny thing about this. This is so meant for engineers. It's
no,
OS.
It's not. It's you know what?
You've
poisoned your mind with this iPhone thing, Jeff. You need to get away from it. Siva, what do you use? What's your phone?
I have an iPhone, but I hate it.
Okay, Siva, this is the phone for you.
Well, except that I live in the middle of nowhere where T-Mobile doesn't work very well.
That's the biggest drawback.
T-Mobile's great in Prague and Budapest, but it's not good in places like rural Virginia, Vermont, Westchester County.
And it's the opposite for Verizon, unfortunately. It works great you are, but not in Prague.
I lived in New York for a long time. I used T-Mobile. It was beautiful in the city. But as soon as I got to Westchester, it didn't work. As soon as I got to Vermont, it didn't work. It was great in Europe, and that's why I had it mostly because I was spending more time in Europe than in most places in the United States. I moved here, had to break my contract for both my wife's phone and my phone with T-Mobile, had to then sign up with AT&T so I could get a phone that would work in Europe, used a BlackBerry for a year till the trackball broke. My wife went to the first generation of iPhone. When it came time for me to replace that BlackBerry, they gave me a great deal. I couldn't refuse it. I wanted to figure out why my wife liked the iPhone so much. I love the apps. I hate all of the Apple native services. I hate being imprisoned by this box. You know, like
that's what this is. This is open ideologically.
I'm totally with the G Phone, but
it's not a sacrifice, Jeff. That's what the problem is. You think this is a sacrifice to be open? This is a step.
I don't want.
All right, I'm going to show you. Look, I'm going to show you the killer app. This is it. This is the killer app. Are you ready? All right, I'm in Twidroid, but it will work anywhere that you can type. When you hit the typing key, you notice there's a little microphone. I am dictating my tweet right now. You can dictate anywhere.
Okay, I want this.
Anywhere there is a keyboard. And it does.
On the wiki, Fred Wilson did that for a whole blog post.
And it's you really? Have to pause.
It was almost English.
No. First of all, you do have to train yourself. It's not perfect. You have to be online because it uses the Google servers for the dictation recognition. You have to speak slowly and enunciate clearly.
You know how easy that is for me, Leo?
Yeah. I'll give you another one. You stop at every period. Because it doesn't do periods. So you have to stop. You have to say a sentence, let it recognize it, press the period key and go on. And I have had perfect dictation. I've been tweeting with it for a couple of days and text messaging for a couple of days. That to me is the killer app. It's done.
So here's the question I put up on the wiki. Are we going to have a keyboardless world, or is that like having a paperless office? It'll never come.
No, I think it solves that problem, although you feel like a dork when you're tweeting in public.
One extra tip for the voice to text. If you're driving or you don't want to look at the keyboard to find that little tiny microphone key, you can swipe your finger across the keyboard to activate it to start.
That's a great tip.
Now again, it's OS by Easter egg.
Well, is it thoroughly documented somewhere, Gina, or is it just we discover it and share?
I have just discovered this one from one of my. Yeah. I discovered it in one of the Google Android tutorial videos. Another good one is if the keyboard is up and you want it to go away, sometimes it blocks like the remember me checkbox. You can swipe down to put it down.
Oh, that's cool. Because I'm always pressing the back button to do that. swipe down.
Yeah, kind of have to there swipe. There you go. Kind of have to swipe quickly. But you know, I listen, Leo, I'm thrilled that you feel this way, but I agree with Jeff a little bit. I still feel like it is an operating system designed by engineers. I think that's clear. I think that it has multiple layers of hierarchy, which the iPhone doesn't have, for better or for worse. I like it because it gives me more options. But the bad news is that things get hidden. So, and I do think it's a little bit like OS by Easter egg. Like, I had no idea that if you tapped and hold those little ellipses that could come up. And in fact, to add to that tip, if you tap and hold the home button, you can see all your currently running apps. It's sort of like...
oh, yeah. Isn't that nice?
Alt tab on the on Windows. So, I mean, these things are hidden. They're not obvious. I get a lot of joy from discovering this stuff.
Me too.
And like, you know, the discovery time with an iPhone is pretty short.
Because it doesn't do diddly-do.
Because it doesn't do as much. But at the same time, it's like, do most people want to invest the time?
It went to the work for us.
You know what, Jeff? I'm telling you, and this is the same thing we said last week. But you may never get to this point, but just give it a little more time, Jeff.
Well, it seems to me
that the iPhone is Baidu, and and this phone is Google. Because basically, Baidu satisfies most people in China for most of their consumer interests, and they're not willing to dig deep, and they just want the easy access to the music. And, you know, if you're a specialized user, a little bit more technologically hip, you might be attracted to Google. And so you may end up with the same market share. If Google's lucky, they get the same market share.
Thanks for bringing us back right around to the
But let me tell you, this is my great hope. Of all the things that Google has done and put itself into in the past 5 years, the mobile phone environment is, to me, the most exciting.
Yes.
And the one in which it can make the most difference in my life and in the world. Because the mobile phone system in the United States is embarrassing.
Broken.
And cruel and expensive. I mean, I ended up, that switch from T-Mobile to AT&T cost me about $1,200 all said and done, with all the broken contracts and new boxes.
Let me point out something. Both AT&T and Verizon this week announced new rate plans because T-Mobile's pay-as-you-go rate plan is starting. I'm telling you, this is the crack in the egg.
Finally.
Yeah.
So do we think Google caused that at T-Mobile? Do you think that was
yes, Google's it was good work? It was for this phone. Yeah, you bet.
If I'm going to wear the Google fanboy hat, it's going to be for the phone activities. What I want to see, though, is a real sort of severing of the habits of long-term contracts, the idea that phones have to be locked to service carriers. I mean, those are the sorts of things that Google really should. And I think hopefully will play a part in.
That's why I wish they had put the AT&T frequency on this phone, because I wouldn't have to go to T-Mobile. I think that was probably a sop to T-Mobile.
That was, I'm sure, the tit for tat.
And that was a compromise, not unlike not showing you Falun Gong
or not putting in multi-touch. I think, look, they live in this world as we do. But
it's their world.
This is we live in Google's. It's Google's world. We just live in it. I think this phone is the closest to an uncompromised phone I've ever seen, and it's unlocked. And
any frustrations with it, Leo?
Well, there are a few apps that I love on the iPhone, like Mint.
The biggest
frustration is no Audible. But Audible is working with Google. It's up to Google to provide it. But Audible is working with them, and they say this first half of 2010 they'll have it. That's the biggest thing, is I can't, it's not an iPod, so I can't listen to my audiobooks. However, you'll see in my tool of the week, there is a very good way to sync this, which I'll talk about.
Oh, I want to hear that. I was going to say the media management is not as good as the iPhone to be expected.
But you can mount an SD card, and I put a 16-gig SD card in it.
That is nice. The replaceable battery, the being able to add more space to stores, definitely. It's fantastic. But the media player isn't as good as it could be. One of my problems is sometimes I accidentally tap one of the buttons on the lower part of the phone while I'm typing. That's kind of annoying. I never did that with the G1 because those buttons were hard buttons.
In fact, these buttons don't seem as responsive sometimes, and I think that's the same issue, is that they're soft buttons, so it's kind of part of the touch screen.
Well, the funny thing about it is when I hold the phone in my hand, I'm fine with the bottom buttons. But when I put it on a table and try to hit it, it somehow doesn't work. It's weird.
I'm sure they did that on purpose.
The other good thing about this is that it does, correct me if I'm wrong, this does do Flash, right?
Supposedly it will be able to. It doesn't come with Flash.
Here's what I found was, I called into Howard Stern's show on
Thursday. By the way, you were on Howard Stern's show.
Yeah, Thursday.
How was that?
It was fine. I love calling in Howard. I called in because he was talking about Jay Leno, and I told him about the time when I gave was TV critic at TV Guide, and when Jay premiered on The Tonight Show, I gave him a bad review, and Jay called me. What? You didn't like the show? No, Jay, I didn't. What did you like about it? Well, that's what I said in the review, Jay. Aren't you gonna watch it?
Tell the truth, though. It was nothing like being on Twit, right? I mean, come on.
No, not at all.
I can get strippers. You want some strippers? We'll get you strippers. Whatever you need.
I didn't plug Twit. I feel very bad.
No, don't worry. Believe me, I don't want Howard Stern's audience listening to this show.
Hey, that's me. But I mentioned on the air that I'm so frustrated I can't get Howard on my iPhone. The hilarious thing was that in minutes, my email was just jammed.
Sure.
Tell me how to do it. There's a couple applications. I'm hesitant to say it out loud because the Chinese government will go after us.
There's illegal redirection of the Howard Stern feed.
Pocket tunes and that kind of stuff. So it kind of fakes Flash. I went on to the Nexus and went to Sirius and went to the player, which is a Flash player, and I got pretty far along. It seemed to be playing, and then I couldn't hear anything.
Oh. Hmm.
So there's something there, but I think that's if you can do Flash, as much as I don't like Flash, getting Flash on this will open it up more too.
There are also people who illegally redirect the Sirius feed.
But no, I still had to put in my password.
Oh,
I still had
okay,
to
good.
Pay $2.99 a month to
oh, that's
get
good.
Online. So no, it was you know,
it was legit.
Sirius lost nothing in
it was
this.
Legit. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Hey, we're running real long, but this has been such a great conversation. Let's quickly get to our tip, number, and tool, but after a commercial. How about that? From our friends at Citrix, the folks who do GoToMeeting, a great solution for people who don't want to travel, who would like to get more done and travel less. GoToMeeting is an indispensable part of how I work today, and I invite you to give it a try for free. The idea is using their great remote access technology, the same technology as in GoToMyPC, they allow you very quickly, very easily to set up online meetings. You can be on the conference call once you've got this installed. In fact, you can install it right now quickly. GoToMeeting.com/twig, 30 days free. And while you're on the conference call, you click a button, you start the meeting, and you say, here's the meeting ID, go to GoToMeeting.com. And now you'll see my desktop. You can see my Mac or my PC desktop. You can see the presentation, the spreadsheet, the websites, whatever it is we're talking about. You can share control so you can collaborate. You can even, once you've got it running, they can give you control of their computer so your clients can say, well, here's my thinking. What do you think? It's so powerful. It truly is indispensable for sales, product demos, training sessions, collaboration. And even one meeting a month will save you over a plane ticket or even a drive across town. It's just $49 a month for as many meetings as you want, as long as you want, including phone and voice over IP conferencing. I want you to try it right now. Go to GoToMeeting.com/twig and try it free for 30 days. You're going to love it. GoToMeeting.com/twig. And now time for Gina's tool of the week.
Tip.
I'm right? Sorry, you're a tip. I'm a tool. I always forget. I don't want to be a tool, but I am.
Quick tip this week, Google has just launched the ability for you to upload files up to, I believe, 250 megabytes in size to Google Docs. So Google Docs becomes kind of this, portable storage place to bring stuff. Now, it's not as, I think you get 1 gigabyte of space, so you can zip up,
But you can buy more, right?
For 25
you can buy
cents,
more, like yeah. You get, yeah, I think you get one gigabyte for free and you can buy more. So you can upload, big old zip files or music files or something and put them in Google Docs. The attachment size limit is, I believe, bigger than on Gmail and most email clients. So it's a similar kind of thing to Dropbox or, even like an online backup like Mozy or Carbonite. Just this place in the cloud to store your stuff and get to access to from any computer. And they said that they're rolling this out over the next few weeks. So you may not have in your Google Docs account right now, but when you do, I think it'll be in a button that just says upload next to the right under the Google Docs logo, and you can choose your file and stow it there.
So if you still
just
trust
in time, in time for the Chinese government.
Right, exactly.
Get your stuff.
I actually thought about making this my tool, Gina, and then I thought maybe this wouldn't be the week to do that. Get all your stuff up there so the Chinese can see it quickly and easily.
Yeah, make sure it's as much sensitive information as possible.
Absolutely.
Social security numbers, bank accounts, just go for it.
I really do wonder if some companies will have second thoughts about using Google Docs because of this. I imagine.
I think the Twitter hack should have done that already.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, that was pretty embarrassing. And to have those two companies involved in something just so obvious. I mean, apparently it was just a dumb password issue, right?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't even
a
forced hack. I mean, a brute force hack. It was just a...
What are the chances that next week the New York Times will report that Google's password was password? No,
it was Marissa.
Jeff Jarvis, time for your number of the week.
Well, according to Flurry, I don't even know them. They're a software company. They put out a report. I don't know about the relative first week sales of phones. And the Nexus One, they say, sold 20,000.
Not many.
The Droid, 250,000. Of course, the Droid had benefit of considerable advertising, not just the Google homepage, but also
and Verizon. Let's not.
That's true. And then, however, you know, a fanboy that I still am for Apple, the iPhone first week was 1.6 million.
Which is, by the way, can I just point out that Nokia sells more phones in a day than Apple sells in a month? Just, you know, if you're going by numbers alone, people are still buying the Nokia candy bar phone.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Globally,
yeah.
In Europe, right? I mean, globally.
It's not here.
World everywhere.
Yeah.
Leo, you know what I saw today? I remember a few months ago you had talked about how much you wanted the new Super Nokia.
N900, I have it, yeah.
So apparently Apple is putting forth a pretty strong patent challenge to keep it out of North America.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, Nokia sued Apple, so it's a mess.
Yeah, over something else, right, yeah. So this is apparently like dueling patent battles right now to limit competition.
Kodak is now suing both Google and Apple over photo displaying. Just, if you can't compete in this country, what do you do? You sue.
Well, that's the thing. Like, let me tell you, the patent system right now is so tangled, so thick with all of these, you know, broad and obvious patents that were approved, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, just on a basic memo, back of a napkin. And you have these, you know, these patent troll companies like the one that almost took down Research in Motion. You know, gathering up all these patents, finding some way to hold somebody hostage. And it's a huge drag. And we pay for it. Who knows how many dollars out of the 500 it's going to cost you for an open droid, you know, an open droid actually has to go for these hostage patents, right? This sort of extortion that's built into the price of almost anything.
Hey, Gina, do you think you never used a Droid? I used a Droid, and I do think that the Nexus One is better than the Droid. It's faster. It's got a gigahertz Snapdragon in it, which really makes a big difference.
And it doesn't have a big clunky keyboard. That's not
Forget
really easy to use to begin
that
with.
We don't want better screen. I think it's a better choice, and 2.1 is an improvement.
Yeah, 2.1 is great, and hopefully the Droid users will get 2.1. Will get pushed down over the air to Droid users soon.
I hope so. Yeah, because it's nice.
Mm-hmm.
My tip of the week is for people who have Android, not necessarily a Nexus One, but Android, and they're saying, well, I really wish, you know, I could sync my songs, my iTunes music, that kind of thing. It comes to us from DVD John, who's, I guess, gone legit or semi-legit anyway. His company's called DoubleTwist, doubletwist.com. This is a free program for Mac or Windows. You can download, install, and then it really is slick. It sees, very much like iTunes does, it sees what's on your Droid phone, and you can sync that up to it. But it also sees what's in your iTunes library. It has an Amazon MP3 music store, so you can buy stuff. You can add feeds. It's pretty sophisticated and a great way to get photos, movies, and music onto your Droid platform. Absolutely free, doubletwist.com. And I think this is a really great solution for people who are saying, well, Nexus One or Droid, it's a great platform, but it's not an MP3. It's not a music player. I think this really puts it back into
contention. So you just obviously install everything straight onto the memory card.
It does it automatically, yeah. In fact, I would suggest upgrading your SD card. It comes with a 4-gig card in the Nexus One, but I you can get a 16-gig card for under $100, and I think that's a nice, if you're going to put a lot of stuff on there. The only thing missing to me at this point is if I can get Audible on here, I'd be done with the iPhone. I really would. So there's my tip, doubletwist.com.
That's what I'm using, yeah.
Oh, you know it already.
Yeah, I knew. DoubleTwist is actually, it's uncannily looks very similar to iTunes, and you know, with the album art and
it's
the
really
different ways
great.
To sync. It's pretty great, yeah, and that is what I'm using. Yeah. So
There's another one from sailing for the folks who use a Mac. SALLING.com Sailing Software has a sync program. It's very similar, but it's not free, so why not use DoubleTwist? Siva, it's so great to have you on. Thank you so much for adding your perspective to this, which one of the biggest news days since this show launched, and frankly, every week's been huge. Google's been so busy since we launched this show. Siva's blog is called The Googleization of Everything. It's a place to go to read about Google and
When is the book coming out, Siva?
We don't have a pub date yet, but it's probably fall. It's weeks like this have slowed it down.
Yeah, no kidding.
We've discussed before.
I bet you would love Google to stop doing stuff.
I thought I had a totally solid China chapter, and now I had to break right back into it.
Are a moving target.
They really are.
No, look, I'm having next the same book's thing about with General Motors, something that doesn't change that fast, right?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
newspapers.
Yeah, newspapers. No, that's not a bad one right now. Jeff Jarvis covers the media. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Siva.
Oh, next book is actually about newspapers. We'll talk about that some other
time. Oh, Siva, we got to talk.
That's Jeff Jarvis's beat.
Yep, they'll be dead.
He's covering the end of journalism as we know it. He also teaches this.
Or causing it, some would say.
Some would say causing it at CUNY, at the City University of New York, in the graduate program in journalism there. And he also is the author of the Buzz Machine blog and the book, What Would Google Do?, available everywhere, including audible.com. And Gina Trapani is still working on the complete guide to Google Wave, completewaveguide.com, any day now.
Oh, yeah, I'm working on the first edition.
Hey, is Wave, I mean, we don't hear much about Wave these days. Is it being changed a lot?
It's definitely not getting the kind of press that it was. And the changes that are coming out are like small kind of, you know, dribs and jabs of this, that, and the other thing. There haven't been any major releases, but just little things here and there. This week they launched suggested contacts. You know, if you create a new Wave and go to add someone, it algorithmically recommends the people who you Wave with the most, which is nice. They added the ability to kind of expand your image thumbnails inside of a Wave. I mean, they're adding little things here and there. I'm kind of, I don't know, I lay awake at night and hope that there's going to be like a major Wave release that integrates with Gmail and like makes the product do all the things that like I feel like it can do and just isn't there yet, but it hasn't happened yet.
Someday.
So we'll see. Hopefully it won't happen before it will happen before I put out the first edition, because I want my book to be obsolete in the first month.
The preview PDF is now available at completewaveguide.com for $6, as Gina says, the price of a sandwich. Better than a sandwich and more nutritional and sustaining. But Gina, I do want to concur with Jeff. When is your Android book coming out? That's the one. That's the one.
Oh, man.
It's begging for it. It's begging. The problem is Android's in moving target. It really is. I'd hate to kind of try to pin this.
We had some requests in Twitter to keep going with this topic of Gina explains the Android to Jeff and the world.
You know, I think maybe next week, if nothing happens.
Sure.
If Google would just take a week off.
Jeff, keep using the phone. Like,
okay,
take the phone with you this week.
And
jot down questions. You know, let's give more questions. Let's do it.
More questions, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be happy to. I love talking about that stuff.
I wake up in the middle of the night. I play with the phone for 3 hours. It's my new girlfriend.
God.
I know it's sad, but it's true. I love this thing. I mean,
I was going to make a crack about all the porn apps in the Android market, but I'm gonna
know nothing about that. That's
that.
Not what I'm playing
that.
With. No, I don't. I'm not looking at that. I'm just loving this thing.
You search for Mint in the Android market, some enterprising developer realized that everyone in the world wants a Mint
app.
That's
all we want is Mint.
Mint.com, but it's actually you get daily Mint girls. Result number one. So...
capitalism.
I'm breaking out the SDK.
Finances or you know, whatever.
Get distracted.
Take that, China.
You wouldn't see that in the iTunes store.
Gina's blog is smarterware.org, a great place to go. In fact, we didn't even talk about some of the really good articles this week you put up there. I actually had them bookmarked and we didn't get around to them. How to tether your Android phone. I thought that was going to be your tip. You do have to root it, though. Do you have to root it?
You don't have to. There are three ways to do it. One is by rooting. Another is by sort of being a sysadmin. And the third is cost $30, but it's super simple.
Oh, okay.
PDA net.
That's what I'm
going
to do.
It worked beautifully for me on my old Trio. May it rest in peace.
All right. PDA net.
It worked great on Android. I mean, it's $30. And in fact, you can use it for free, but you just can't access any HTTPS, any encrypted connections. But yeah, pay $30, install the software on your computer, and you put the app on your Android phone, and you can get online from anywhere. And actually, I said in my blog post, I think I'm getting old because I decided to go that route instead of rooting it.
Yep.
I think given China, I think everything will be HTTPS now.
yeah, you better.
So you can't use Gmail if you...
That's very clever, though. That's a very clever way to do the freemium, which is you can see if it works. You just can't do Gmail. Not that you need to because you got Gmail on there. That's cool.
Well, you'd have your Gmail cached in the Gmail app on Android, but I'm pretty sure that app makes encrypted connections to Gmail, so it wouldn't sync. You know what I mean? So if you were tethering, it wouldn't sync. But you could still use your Gmail offline using the Gmail app on Android, which is pretty cool.
How do you do Android screenshots? Are you just taking a picture?
Oh, it's the worst. There's no screenshot app built in. This is the one thing. I mean, the iPhone. I don't know. This iPhone
is built in. Yeah.
On the iPhone, you press the two buttons and you have a screenshot. With Android, it is like a process. You have to install the SDK, connect the phone to your computer, bring up this debugger thing, and then save screenshots from there. It is a rigmarole. And it's one of those things where if the Android developers want people to show off Android, there should be an easier way to take screenshots, you know? So, yes.
We should look. I bet you if there's an API call to shoot the screen, that would be an easy app to write.
There are some apps, but you have to have root access to run. So there's some sort of hardware layer protection in the hardware that isn't letting Android take screenshots. It's weird. I don't understand why they haven't figured this out.
What we want Android to be.
we could do that. Really great blog. Must read if you're into iPhone or anything productivity-wise. SmarterWare.org. Siva, Jeff, Gina, thank you so much for joining us. You can watch us do this show live 5:15 Eastern, 2:15 Pacific every Saturday at live.twit.tv. But do subscribe on iTunes or use Google Listen, which I'm loving, by the way, on this thing. Or if you have a Zune, we're in the Zune marketplace too. Just search for Twig. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us on This Week in Google.